Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Diana Brixner, and on the behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you all today to today's educational activity entitled Addressing Barriers in Advancing Equitable Biomarker Testing in Community Oncology. Today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech Incorporated and administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. A little bit of background on myself. I'm currently Professor Emeritus in the Department of Pharmacotherapy at the University of Utah, and I'm a member of the Huntsman Cancer Institute Cancer Control and Population Sciences Program, as well as a member of our Center of Genomic Medicine, all based in Salt Lake City, Utah. And at this point, I'd like to offer the other faculty members the opportunity to introduce themselves.
Hi, everyone. I'm Zach Rivers. I'm a senior scientist at Tempus AI, based out of Chicago, and then in my free time, still a clinical oncology pharmacist at the University of Vermont Medical Center.
And hello, everyone. It's an honor to be here today to represent the patient's voice. I'm Dusty Donaldson. I'm a 19-year lung cancer survivor and a patient advocate, founder of Live Lung, which is a 501c3 dedicated to lung cancer, the lung cancer community. I'm also the president of the Lung Cancer Action Network, which is an association of all the U.S.-based nonprofits with a focus on lung cancer.
Thank you so much. As you can see, I think we have a great group to have an interactive discussion on the topics, as well as getting feedback from all of you in the audience as well. So let's go through our learning objectives for today. Learning objective number one, we have four of them. We want to evaluate the latest biomarker testing strategies in prostate, bladder, and lung cancer, and we specifically want to look at their impact on treatment decision making. Learning objective number two, we want to integrate all members of the care team in strategies to provide equitable biomarker testing in community oncology settings. Learning objective number three, we're going to try to identify some of the root causes of health inequity in cancer care and discuss how we can perhaps address those. And learning objective number four, we want to talk about how we can incorporate such action-oriented strategies to address unconscious bias, patient social determinants of health in cancer care management. So moving on to our topic around cancer biomarkers. It was interesting. I was asked to do a small brief interview prior to our presentation today. And the question was, why are you interested in being part of this presentation, and why do you think it's important? Well, my background, I've been very involved with the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, and it's really apparent that in order to make informed decisions about coverage and utilization management, you really need to understand your disease area and topic. And I can certainly agree that the whole idea of biomarkers in cancer, how they identify the right treatment, all the processes involved in the appropriate utilization are complex. And therefore, this session today is a great opportunity to really move forward on that concept of education so that we all collectively can make better, more informed decisions that really focus on optimizing outcomes, but again, understanding and having awareness of what the impact is on overall costs of healthcare. So with that framework, I'll talk a little bit about cancer biomarkers in general. There are many types of cancer biomarkers. They can be predictive, and they're indicative of therapeutic efficacy because there's an interaction between a biomarker and a therapy relevant to the patient outcome. They can be prognostic and giving you some information on what the odds are of survival independent of the treatment received. Oncotype DX comes to mind in breast cancer here. And then also biomarkers can be genes, proteins, lipids, metabolites, bits of DNA or microRNA. And many of these can be identified now in a new technology called liquid biopsies instead of tissue samples. Biomarker testing to detect actionable targets as a part of a diagnostic workup can really help in personalizing care. And I think this is what is such an exciting aspect for healthcare teams and managed care as well, is how can we really maximize that opportunity for precision oncology and really improve the treatment decisions that we make. The use of biomarkers, when used appropriately, really can reduce the overall cost of care, but I certainly appreciate that there is not a lot of evidence out there that demonstrates those improvements and decrease in costs, and we really need to all focus on how can we better do that.
Diane, do you mind if I just underscore and emphasize
absolutely.
The bottom part of this slide? I just can't emphasize this enough, but, you know, the biomarkers point to more effective, less toxic therapies while avoiding ineffective therapies and unnecessary toxicities. And the overall cost of cancer care is reduced by the use of biomarkers. So I just wanted to emphasize that as a patient advocate.
Well, thank you so much for that. And I think follow-up for all of us, we need to work together and generate more evidence of that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Zach, did you have a comment?
No, just
okay. Just agreeing.
Okay.
So some other comments on cancer biomarkers. The National Comprehensive Cancer Network, NCCN, guidelines recommend biomarker testing in most patients with cancer. And what I've seen in my world in managed care, being involved on P&T committees, is that these are really taken as gospel. And decisions are often made simply based on where a biomarker is categorized in NCCN guidelines. And I think, as you'll learn today, the real decisions around this are much more complex, they're much more intricate, and a lot more considerations really should be made other than just where a drug and a biomarker is placed in these NCCN guidelines. And again, everything is evolving so quickly, it's hard to expect that these NCCN guidelines are going to keep up with what the latest technology is in biomarkers in cancer. So another important comment is that biomarker testing is not the same as genetic testing. So anyone can have genetic testing to identify inherited mutations that predispose them to cancer. Somatic biomarker testing is specific to cancer, since cancer has undergone mutations that make it different than the patient. There can be some overlap, and that's again where it gets confusing. BRCA mutations, Lynch syndrome, are just an example where we see the utilization of both genetic and somatic testing. The biomarker testing may or may not be necessary prior to using specific targeted therapies. It's complicated and constantly evolving. The bottom line summary of this slide, though, is that in almost all cancer types, biomarker analyses are recommended prior to initiating therapy. And I think this is an important consideration now for health plans and insurers to decide at what threshold, what level, what evidence should that biomarker be accepted and approved. So let's take a little bit of a path down what actionable cancer biomarkers are. If there is an actionable biomarker, so in other words, there's a treatment that is targeted based on that biomarker, there's more of a common acceptance to coverage for that particular biomarker. So actionable biomarkers in bladder cancers, there's one particular one. In non-small cell lung cancer, we have several that have actionable drug treatments. And in prostate as well, there are several. So there's another concept called tumor agnostic. Again, adding another layer of complexity, these biomarkers actually can indicate actionable drugs for various different types of tumors. So what do you do? Next slide talks a little bit about this idea of this rising use of multi-gene biomarker analysis, which makes a lot of sense. So if we're looking at any particular disease, let's not just look at all these individual biomarkers. Let's look at them as a panel. Let's look at them all together. And this slide shows you just a few of the different options and types of multi-gene biomarker analyses that are available. What I do see on this slide is that as you look at these different options, you see you gain more information. However, the cost of these tests then increase, and another impact is turnaround time. how long will it take to actually get these results, and how does that impact a rather anxious patient that's sitting in a hospital or a clinic as far as knowing that they're actually having treatment that's starting to take care and treat that cancer. This slide, I'm not going to spend too much time on. You are all going to get the slides, but it talks a little bit about some of the benefits and limitations of different biomarker assessment techniques. So again, it follows on the previous slide showing that these are not easy decisions. First of all, what type of test? Is it a single test? Is it a panel for a certain cancer, or is it an all-inclusive panel that gives you information even on non-actionable markers that may not be valuable today if there's not a treatment, but could be valuable in the future if a clinical trial becomes available that suddenly now is an actionable treatment for one of the biomarkers that were tested? Dusty, did you want to make a comment to that? I thought you had an example to share.
Yeah. About the sequential testing where you're just checking for one and then waiting for that result to come in, checking for a different one if that one was negative. I've known patients who were actually lying in the hospital waiting for test results and in a community setting, and the doctor was doing one at a time. The patient passed away before they ever found out if they did have, they didn't finish all the different tests. And It's just a shame, in my opinion, that the more comprehensive testing isn't done right from the get-go, because the patient is eager to get treatment for that cancer. They want that cancer out of their body, and the doctors are oftentimes eager to do that. Sometimes they kind of jump the gun, and they'll start traditional chemotherapy before they get those test results in, only to find out that what a waste of time and money by doing that, because then they ultimately have a very highly effective targeted therapy that they can go on. But yes, I've seen a lot of this happen over the years, so I'd like to see more comprehensive biomarker testing done up front at the time of diagnosis.
Right, and I think we need to demonstrate what the actual value is of that down the road over a population. So to that point, let's talk a little bit about biomarker testing coverage. This is the issue that we do not live in a world, as Dusty described it, where either reflexive testing is done as soon as you're diagnosed, the panel should go out, a full panel with all the information. Well, we have a lot of policies behind this as well. And in fact, as of May 2024, 15 states have laws that are mandating biomarker coverage. Now, despite this, there's still over 50% of the U.S. population that may not be covered by legislative mandates, even in those states governing insurance coverage. And if you think about what might those reasons be, a lot of it comes around to health disparities, and we're going to hear Zach talk about that. So these state mandates, those that are unable to access care or are not covered, they're not influenced by a mandate coverage decision. So there still is significant concern, even in states where there are mandates that are in place. Overall, we have greater than 2 million individuals that are estimated to be diagnosed with cancer in 2024 in the United States. And recognizing that the cost is over $1,200 for a broad panel biomarker testing. So it doesn't take much to see that a health plan is going to do a quick calculation based on the number of members I have in my plan. This is the top threshold of how much I might be spending on these biomarker panels. Is there a way I can decrease that spend? But we need to recognize what are the consequences of not spending that money up front down the line. And then finally, 66% of oncology providers report a lack of biomarker testing coverage as a barrier to care. I think this is such a call to action for all of us in the room, and again, particularly in managed care. We need to increase the dialogue between oncology providers and payers to understand both perspectives, and so that together we can be making the right decisions about coverage for our patients.
This 66%, two-thirds of oncology providers believe either if that's true, that the coverage is actually lacking, or that they just presume it is. I don't know, but that is shocking. Mm-hmm. That's a shocking statistic right there.
Right. And I find it high as well. I think, and so maybe it's more even a matter of education of providers, EMR systems that are bringing flags that saying, yes, this patient's diagnosed here. Here are all the biomarkers that are covered, right? So there's many ways we can hopefully try to address this. So if we look now at the commercial population and the Medicaid population, and we're looking at coverage, what are some of the testing patterns by insurance type? Well, you can see here we have a lot of different biomarker tests that are over on the y-axis, on the x-axis, and the y we see the percent of patients that are actually getting these tests. So it's clear if you look at it overall, coverage is not comprehensive. There are issues that remain that are concerning to providers. There is a, and then this is one of mine that I've talked about a lot. There is a disconnect between covering the test versus the drug, which has always been a mystery to me, but I've seen it over and over actually in practice. When there is a medical benefit and a pharmacy benefit in a health plan, often the medical benefit side is the one making the decision on the biomarker test. The pharmacy benefit side is the one making the decision on the drug. And more often than not, you'll see that a biomarker test is covered. Great news. And then they go to prescribe the appropriate drug, and it's not covered. So that's a dilemma, but you can flip it. Imagine that the pharmacy benefit puts the drug on the formulary for coverage, but the biomarker test that's telling you that this drug will work in that patient isn't covered. So in either scenario, we are not optimizing our coverage decisions for patient outcomes.
I would like to share a patient story. It's Elizabeth, my friend. She's from the same town in North Carolina where I live, and I've known Elizabeth for 7 years now. Elizabeth is, I think, a perfect case study for this whole topic because when Elizabeth was diagnosed, her oncologist gave her basically an expectation that she would live for 100 days without treatment, maybe 120 days with traditional chemotherapy. Now, there was no actionable biomarker for her, but fortunately, her oncologist in the community care setting did order biomarker testing for her, and she had a biomarker, and she entered a phase one clinical trial. Now, she was given 100 to 120 days to live. It's been 7 years now, and it's because she went into this phase one clinical trial. Now there is an FDA-approved targeted therapy for that biomarker, which is the RET biomarker. And she has lived to see all three of her children get married. She calls it the race to the altar. And she's got grandchildren now. And her husband are living a wonderful life, traveling around the country. And frankly, this is a dramatic and impactful story. I think that it's going to be in the resources later. If you want to hear Elizabeth's story in her own words, I'd encourage you to look at that, because this is there should be a lot more Elizabeths than what we're hearing about.
Thank you for sharing that. So a few other issues around biomarker testing by insurance type. A retrospective analysis of nationwide U.S. healthcare databases of patients receiving a diagnosis of advanced non-small cell lung cancer from 2011 to 2019 gave you these results that you see here on the screen. The assessment of biomarker testing across these different types was considered, and overall what we're seeing is there is a higher percentage of patients receiving biomarker testing in commercial insurance coverage versus Medicaid coverage. A lot of this probably is due to access issues, health disparities that we're going to move into later on. But these disparities need to be addressed. And how do we, A, not at least make these numbers equal, but really rise all boats and bring the testing levels up? So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Zach and give you a chance to ask some questions and have some dialogue.
Oh. Awesome. Thanks, Diana. So to give everyone a chance to wake up a little bit, I think this is a survey question that you can interact with. Which of the following did community oncology clinicians, so community versus academic, identify as the factor that would make them least likely to order biomarker testing for a patient with non-small cell lung cancer? We have A, low economic status, B, low health literacy, black ethnicity, option number C, D, an older patient, or E, I don't know. Awesome. Mm-hmm. So A, thank you for engagement, not A necessarily being the answer. I've been to some other ones this week where no one engaged, so it's great to see this.
Thank you.
And so we're seeing here a pattern that a priori I would have sort of agreed with, that socioeconomic status is the biggest driver in a room full of managed care professionals where we're really thinking about dollars and cents. But then sort of low health literacy, older patients, and not knowing pop up as well. And then black ethnicity sort of got our lowest score. And when we pivot to the actual results from this publication, so this was a survey in 2020, we see that low health literacy, so the panel in the top right stratifies how the likelihood, and so we see that low health literacy providers would be less likely, so moderately likely, slightly likely, or not at all likely to order these for patients. And then we also see that same trend, though less robustly, in the socioeconomic status group. And so I think this is really, really important on the bottom here, too, is that there's a lot of people that are having this conversation with their patients, but then the clinicians are sort of inserting a barrier at this point, saying, hey, I'm going to talk to you about this, but my judgment is that you're not likely to be able to follow through with this whole process. And so to me, this really stands out as an equity issue where we're either not empowering patients, which I think, Dusty, you can talk to now if you'd like, or later when we get there, to advocate. But more importantly, these patients, as a patient, I haven't been sitting in that chair, but I can imagine that it's really scary and intimidating to sort of have all of these things thrown at you. And more importantly, I think, in addition to empowering the patients, we need to be really educating the clinicians and supporting the clinicians to say, regardless of your perceived notion of this patient in front of you, biomarker testing is recommended as a standard of care across this population, and you should be breaking down those barriers to do that for your patient.
Absolutely, Zach. And I told you about Elizabeth, and she was very fortunate that her doctor did her biomarker testing, so early in her diagnosis. And yet, when I look at this slide and consider the previous question that the survey that everyone took, I mean, Elizabeth and her husband are both medical professionals, and the burden shouldn't be on the patient to know these things about biomarker testing and to ask for biomarker testing. Our nonprofit, we empower and educate patients, and that is really important, and yet really the onus lies on the provider. They really, like Zach was saying, this is the standard of care, and they're the ones who really need to do that and put their own, whether perceived or unperceived, biases to the side and follow the guidelines.
Yeah. And I think, too, we see, so again, in the same survey, some other results here that are really interesting to me. The pink is the academic clinicians, and the blue is the community clinicians. We see that some of this may actually be due to systemic or societal health system level barriers, right? If you're a community clinician, and you perceive that it's going to take a month to get this result back, and you have a patient where you're also worried about their health literacy, their ability to understand how they're moving through this really complex system, you may not feel confident or prepared to explain to them, hey, I just told you you're likely dying of this disease, but the best course of action is for you to wait a month for this test result to come back. Mm-hmm. And so figuring out how we, on the systems level, can better empower clinicians to have these conversations, I think, is really important. The other contrast that we see here is when the clinicians reported they would order the biomarker testing. And so academic clinicians are more likely to do this up front again and say, yep, I want these results right away. I want this to be part of my staging conversation. Whereas community clinicians are saying, hey, I'm going to wait a little bit longer. And again, I wasn't there. I don't know what this relationship is between the health literacy conversations, but I can again imagine that doing it later reduces some complexity in the eye of the clinician that they would have to communicate to their patient, whereas doing it sooner, as we saw earlier in Diana's conversation, empowers people to make these results. So I'm hopeful, you know, this survey was 4 years ago now, so I'm hopeful that we've seen some positive change there. But I think we still have a long way to go here as we move forward.
And if I could just interject, I think we, all of us in this space have room for improvement. I mean, you know, up to 14 days, that to me seems reasonable to plan, you know, to wait for that biomarker test result. And yet, I mean, you know, you might have 14 days when you're scheduling radiation or chemotherapy or something else like that as well. So that's sort of kind of reasonable. I remember when I got diagnosed, my doctor, I was eager to get treatment, and he said, it's not an emergency, but it's urgent. But when you're talking about a month, I think we really need to do better than that. So hopefully, you know, things will move along. We'll find more efficient ways of getting those results back. And I also just wanted to just mention these community providers, because most cancer patients are treated in the community care setting. And frankly, you know, that's usually more where they feel comfortable, and that's important to them. And so we can't just tell everyone, just go to the academic centers to get better care. Yeah. They need to feel comfortable where they're being treated. But the community providers are oftentimes treating all kinds of cancers. And frankly, lung cancer was the advancements were few and far between for decades until just, you know, the past, you know, 10 to 15 years, things have been moving at lightning speed, and it's hard for anyone to keep, it's hard for me to keep up as a patient advocate with these new biomarkers, these new targeted therapy, the new clinical trials that are coming out. And so, you know, kind of not an excuse, but the logic behind that is they are treating all kinds of cancer, and it's really hard for them to keep up. But hey, the guidelines are here, and you know, it really should hopefully, you know, make it easy. Just get the biomarker testing, and then you know what to do.
Yeah, I want to take another minute on this slide because I think it's such an important one. And Zach, particularly with your experience that you bring to our dialogue today, I'm looking at these numbers and trying to understand. I mean, I presented a slide a few slides back that showed that okay, maybe some of these large panels with a lot of biomarkers, they seem to take longer. I guess I can believe that. You need to run different tests, et cetera. But are there process measures on top of realistic measures that definitely take more time, but process measures that are feasible in the labs that are doing these tests to try to get results back quicker?
I think there's definitely some processes when you're making a decision about where you allow your patients to receive their testing, that there are some labs and different places that have either efficiencies of scale where they're running sequencing in parallel for all of these things,
right,
or they have the capability to run it more quickly. And I know that the literature doesn't exist, that a lot of labs are sort of black boxy around their turnaround time. And so I'm actually hopeful that looking at people in this room that can have some of that impact can turn around to the labs that you're discussing contracting with and say, hey, what is your turnaround time? You know, I know that you're covering all of these, that you're doing all of the genes that we care about, but is that taking you a month and a half, or is that taking you 14 days? And including that in part of your cost process, because as we've seen, right, that the getting that earlier turnaround time is beneficial to this.
Thank you so much for that. And again, in my world in managed care, there's a lot of talk about outcomes-based contracts. Those as well are very complex, and we never know what is the right outcome to measure. But here's a really interesting example to me. So take it away from drugs and take it actually to the tests that are being done. And an ability, it seems like a very readily measurable outcome, turnaround time. So, and it can be an outcomes based. Look, you're telling me that you're going to deliver on average test results within X days. Great. Let's sign a contract to this price, and then we go back in a year and we look at how close to that turnaround time did you come, and that's going to actually impact what we're going to pay you for the test. Because it's not just about the test. This slide shows me that it's a lot about how soon can you get the results of that test to your patient. So please use your screens if you have comments, if you have questions around any of our topics so far. Don't hesitate to enter them in. So.
Yeah, and Diana, to your point, I think this slide as well really illustrates that conversation. The table's a little bit busy here, but we see in the first column the number of patients included in this retrospective study with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Then, so the total number of patients, then patients that got any biomarker test, which is a relatively high number, good, glad to see that, 90%. But then only 46% got all five of the biomarker tests. And then you see that sort of broken down below that. But then as we move to the right, this is where, clinically speaking, it's really interesting and sort of disappointing to me. We see somewhere in the 70%, 70 to 80%, got all five of those results before they started first-line therapy. But then we still have 25% of the patient population that got the results after the clinician had started first-line therapy. And we've seen data. There was a discussion earlier this week about the importance of waiting to get those results before sort of starting, that the data sort of reflected that getting results is really important here. And so this is an area, again, where I think, you know, we see the bottom bullet point that we're not waiting for months and months here to start therapy still. It's a 35-day turnaround time. And Dusty, I'm guessing from your experience, right, there's a lot of chaos during those 35 days. And so it's not unreasonable to say, okay, we're going to wait another day or two while we get these results to make the right decision. But I think this real-world study is really powerful in showing that we're letting some patients fall through the cracks here, where we could, through better coordination of care, and I think those of us that are sort of in the community versus academic space also know that that's something that the community practices, because it's one oncologist usually treating all comers, they don't maybe have a clinical care coordinator. They don't maybe have a patient navigator built into the clinic for them because there's not that resourcing, an area where we sort of from the top-down payer perspective can better support that.
I so agree with that. I guess my comment here, too, another reasonably actionable criteria is looking at utilization management is that if you're going to cover a biomarker test, it's certainly not unreasonable to expect that when the oncologist gets the results of that test, the patient, perhaps even automatically, gets put on the appropriate targeted therapy, and preventing this concept of clinical inertia, which is very real and somewhat understandable. On the oncologist side, hey, I went ahead and put the patient on the drug while we're waiting for the test results, and they're doing okay. They're managing, they're maintaining progression-free survival, seems to be positive. There's a hesitancy to say, I'm going to actually now switch you. But again, if we have more evidence to show that if I do switch you, yes, there'll be a transition, but you're going to have XYZ increased overall survival, XYZ increased progression-free survival, that these are important outcomes to the patient, and that those decisions should be discussed and made collectively as a healthcare team.
In addition to quality of care, I mean quality of life.
Of course.
Yeah, and so I think, again, we really stack these slides quite nicely, because I think this sort of ties into some clinical inertia that we see here, too. This is probably one of the most powerful studies I've read in the past couple of years, looking at process gaps. I'm a huge, if you know me outside of this, which I actually don't think anybody in this room does, but congratulations, you're going to learn a little bit of me of outside of this. I love process improvements. I love understanding how system failures can be changed, can be tweaked to drastically improve these outcomes, right? So this was a study that was normalized to 1,000 patients. I'm going to skip all the way to the bottom of it, to the bottom right. You end up only having 356 of those 1,000 patients that got the appropriate treatment in this process. I don't think anybody in this room, no matter what part of the system you touch, would be happy with that number. But we're all part of the system and how that happens, whether it's in a biopsy referral process, right? Is it the patient's at a community center, they need to get referred to an academic center, and that academic center isn't in network, but it's the closest one to them. Otherwise, they're driving 3.5 or 4 hours to get a different biopsy. Is it a test treatment decision process, right? The clinician isn't supported to navigate the complexity of the decision tree that's presented to them in a reasonable time and, you know, submit the prior authorization, find time for the peer-to-peer, do all of those things. And so there's that, again, that clinical inertia of, okay, I already started you on carbapemetrexed, something like that, and so you're doing okay on it. So I think to me, this slide, if you take nothing else away from this talk, which I hope you take more, but to go back and think about where each of you touches this patient's journey, one of these 1,000 patients, and think about if there's anything you can do to drop that percentage lost by 1%, right? Those are real people that you can have that impact on.
Yes, Zach. I mean, this just grieves me when I look at this and I consider the missed opportunities. And as Zach said, these aren't just numbers. These are people, brothers and sisters, and mothers and fathers. And it's a huge loss. And we need to do better.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Dusty. It looks like we're getting some questions for the audience.
Here I thought, they don't have any questions, but apparently I had a dead iPad, and okay, we have quite a few questions now, but let's keep going.
Do you want to digest those? Yeah, yeah. So I think I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, and I promise this will sort of tie all back together, but one of the really important things we need to think about when we're doing these system-based updates, right? If you're all leaving here today supercharged, going to go back and be like, great, I'm going to make these changes, is to make sure that your changes are equitably rolled out across the entire patient population. I'm guessing that if you're here listening about biomarkers in cancer, you've probably heard about Oncotype DX recurrence scores, Mammoprint, sort of these prognostic scoring systems. But and these are great from a clinical standpoint, right? You're able to look at patients and say, hey, you're at a really low risk for recurrence, so we're not going to give you this life-altering chemotherapy, radiation, surgery process, we're going to monitor you and surveil you over time. And the data held up in the clinical trials, but when we went to a real-world population and sort of retrospectively looked back, we found that there were only 5% of the population built into the study were black women. And so that doesn't resemble the real-world population at all. And so where this training, right, we're in this AI space now too, and so this prognostic score was trained on a population that doesn't match the entire population that's going to receive that care. And so when you're thinking about this through an equity lens, which goes back to some of our learning objectives, you know, it's not just a rush to make sure that we're getting biomarker testing out the door and saying, look, everyone can have a biomarker test, this is great, but making sure that the biomarker products, the biomarker testing approaches you're supporting are developed and available in an equitable manner so that it truly benefits the entire population. It's not just concentrating health benefit in potentially an already benefited population. I'll hand it back over to you to do the next couple slides here, but also we can pause for questions if there's any that have jumped out to you.
So there are a few, some great questions here. So I will present one or two that are relevant to the recent conversations that we've had. And, you know, the first one was, if everyone recognizes the importance of biomarkers, then why are there such payer barriers in covering the cost of biomarkers? I'll make an initial comment to that and ask my panelists to share any other thoughts they might have. But I think it all comes down to evidence. And as we saw on the one slide, there is a range of cost of biomarkers to single tests, which are relatively inexpensive, to full panels that can be over $1,500, $2,000, $3,000. So I think making the decision to have coverage of all of that requires more evidence on the value of that coverage. And I'm hoping that all of us are learning today about how we can better generate that evidence to improve the value of these biomarker tests.
Well, I would just like to say, I mean, I'm not an operations person, but I would say that it just seems to make sense to me that the more biomarker testing we're doing, it's going to drive the cost down. We've got a lot of laboratories doing biomarker testing now, and I think the competition and the technology advances, I'm hopeful that the cost of biomarker testing will decrease, but, you know, it's just the part of care. It's the standard of care, and until it does, you know, we just need to suck it up.
I know, I agree. Well, I'm going to say that one other comment that's related to this is there and it's good news, is there are trends on retesting for biomarkers. And certainly in my experience, and if either one of you have different experiences, that I don't think retesting is an issue. I think each individual diagnosis of a cancer and metastasis of a cancer, either in the same organ or other organs, is an individual decision of, is it appropriate to do a biomarker or not? I don't think retesting is an issue. I think the issue is coverage up front in the first place. So perhaps that's a bit of good news. So, okay, we did talk a little bit about improving processes, so I won't repeat that one. But I will bring up this one last one, and then I'll go back to our slides, is are there panels that providers can order that will make it easier to choose the correct biomarkers and less likely to choose just one? So I see this question going right to that slide that I had about the NCCN guidelines, where that is a very static recommendation, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing from this question, is there anything that could be a bit more dynamic and interactive between oncology providers and payers, such that the decision of which biomarkers to use for certain diagnostics, there's more clarity and not as much uncertainty and ambiguity. So I would like to say, we talked, there's a program yesterday, a little bit about having payer panels of oncologists, quality experts, the providers that are collectively helping the payer inform them about these issues and making more informed decisions. Any other thoughts on that?
I love that question.
Yeah, because
it shows me that somebody is wanting to do the right thing and is not exactly sure, how to move forward with that. But I'm not sure we have, like I said, I can't even keep up with the FDA targeted therapies, the approval for them. I think we've got maybe 10 or 12 different biomarkers that have FDA approval for targeted therapies. But, I mean, a minimum of those. But, as a patient advocate, I would like to see more. I go back to Elizabeth. Her RET mutation was not, it didn't have a targeted therapy that was FDA approved at the time. But she was part of that phase one clinical trial. And now it is FDA approved and standard of care. But I understand if there are restrictions from doing more comprehensive, but a minimum of every single one that we already have FDA approval for targeted therapies. And lung cancer is the number one cancer killer. It kills more than the next three cancers combined. And so, and if you remember that slide early on where we had all those actionable biomarkers, lung is where it's happening. And so, thankfully, because we need it desperately.
So I have to add one more question because it's so in line with this discussion here. So one of our virtual audience members, why should we pay for multi-gene panels when there is only at most a handful of actionable targets in a given cancer like bladder? That is a great question. And here's another thought. So as we look at limited resources and perhaps not the ability to carte blanche cover every single biomarker, we could start to create tiers or thresholds of coverage. And I could understand, so in bladder cancer where there's one actionable mutation, okay, maybe it does make sense to only and fully cover that particular biomarker that has an FDA-targeted therapy. But in others, and we can also look at, are there clinical trials and what stages are they in, and would it perhaps make sense to include a couple others that might be close? But if you could do that type of an analysis, almost have a checklist for the cancer type and the available biomarkers, the available actionable treatments, and the clinical trials that may have treatments coming up. If that could be something like, I don't know, a 10-question, survey that the provider and the patient and the payer together are all looking at and making consistent decisions. So great question, and I think that's something that we could certainly build on.
So. Yeah, and I think, not to drive us on to the next slide here, but I think the other really important thing to consider here is not only the limited resources in terms of the finances available to like the payer group that's covering a group of cancer patients, but also the tissue samples that are available, right?
Yeah.
That, our next slide here, Dana, which I'll hand over to you, but I just wanted to make this segue because I think it's really important, is that there are other resources that are a factor in testing outside of the finances.
And let's take a look at that. So Tissue limitations, absolutely a significant barrier, particularly, Dusty, as I'm sure you're well aware, in non-small cell lung cancer. Prospectively enrolled patients with previously untreated disease that may undergo tissue biopsies based on the physician's discretion. Standard of care is tissue genotyping, submitted a pre-treatment blood sample for this comprehensive cell-free DNA analysis. But the fact is that if you look at the amount of tissues available as the number of biomarkers increase, this starts to become a limiting factor. This is very real, and I know we're going to talk a little bit later about liquid biopsies. This slide here is showing you where there is the opportunity of cost effectiveness and better outcomes of liquid biopsies, but yet again, there's very limited evidence on this. Some additional barriers to biomarker testing. Okay, we've talked about payer coverage. I wanted to present this one study, which is, again, shows that there's a lot of room for improvement. It is 4 years ago, 246 cases in New York showed that a majority of tests were denied payer coverage. Only 10.75% of a total NGS service panel charge was reimbursed. So coverage through private payers is variable. I think a lot of it is not based on relevant, recent information, innovative research, looking at the future, and hopefully this will change over time.
This slide in particular, I find it abhorrent. It's a travesty that 1%, I'm hoping that things have dramatically changed since then, but it's just a travesty, it really just gets my blood boiling when I see it. So, hopefully, I know everyone in this room is going to be doing better than that, and everyone who is watching is going to be doing better than that, but definitely, we can all do better than that.
I think that's the message. Okay. So, Zach, I'm going to turn it over to you about health disparities, an area of your expertise. You've done a lot of great research and published in this area, so we look forward to hearing your comments.
Yeah, thank you. So, we've talked about, right, all of these sort of partial coverages or sort of segmented coverage of some patients are getting, right? We see on this slide that there is a 1% that we should probably celebrate. Hey, you got this. But
That's Elizabeth.
Yeah,
it's Elizabeth.
But exactly, right? That was, if we're going to talk about being healthcare privileged, if you and your partner are both healthcare workers, you are healthcare privileged and you are going to be part of that really small group. And so I think it's really important when we think about disparities to, I'm a social science PhD, so I like frameworks, and I really like this framework talking about different factors of health disparities. And I think that it's something that a lot of us in this room have probably been trained to focus on a person's responsibility for their disease or a person's responsibility for not making changes after they've been diagnosed, when really we need to take a step back and understand how we can support both the community that that person exists in as well as the systems of care that underline that community to really support them to make those changes. Because I think more and more data is coming out to show that, we're talking about non-medical socioeconomic circumstances that are preventing them from being healthy, but it all comes back to the system around them. And so thinking about when you're designing coverage policies, how your policies, on paper may look like they're addressing a person's needs, right? You're saying, great, we're going to cover, we're going to reimburse your Uber to your mammogram or to your colonoscopy. That's a great thing. But if no Uber drivers go to that part of town where that patient lives, or if the patient isn't technologically literate enough to use the Uber app to get the patient, to get an Uber to show up. So it's really important to think about all parts of health disparities, all the factors that sort of go into that. And building off of that too, we see cancer care disparities and cancer cause disparities as well. Where for a long time, these behavioral factors, and I still struggle necessarily with them being truly behavioral factors or if they're upstream environmental factors that patients are surrounded with, but these are all evidence-based factors that cause cancer. And think about how structural and systemic racism or other biases, other discrimination, then flip those factors as well. So I think it's really important, you know, leave here thinking about, wow, there's all these really cool biomarkers. I want to go back and develop a in-house molecular tumor board for my managed care team that I'm on. But also take a step back and think about, great, I'll have this molecular tumor board, but how do I make sure that all patients covered under my plan will have access to those services and be able to benefit from those services? And so until we tackle some of these cancer care disparities and cancer disparities in general, we can't just leave with that charge to do a better job with testing. We need to make sure that we're addressing all of these.
Yeah. It is an environment, right?
Yeah. And so I think this, you know, we're talking about biomarker testing. And we see here that insurance coverage is really important for biomarker testing. And we see in patients, so this is a study that looked at patients with non-small cell and then non-squamous non-small cell, so a subtype of it. And we see the researchers here stratified by patients who self-identified as being white and self-identified as being black or African-American. And I'll pause here because I think it's really important. We, as statisticians, as data scientists, like to put patients in buckets. And data has come out recently that shows that these buckets aren't actually the right buckets to put patients in, and that we often use race as a proxy or a surrogate measure for socioeconomic status or health status. So here, yes, these authors use race, but I really want to challenge you to think about what the actual mechanism is there, because it's very unlikely to be a patient's self-reported race or genetic ancestry that influences whether or not they get care, and more likely this was just a way that we bucketed patients. But here we see a statistically significant and I think clinically significant difference of, you know, between 10 and, I'm doing math on the fly here, between 6 and 10% of patients who ever got tested and got NGS testing prior to first-line therapy based on race here. So I think it's really important, again, if you're a payer, you say, great, I'm going to cover this. Mm-hmm. Okay, you cover it for your whole population. How do you make sure that these numbers are equal in that process? How are we thinking about equity there as well? I think this is one of the areas, too, where it's really important in going back to that Oncotype DX study is making sure that the data we're using to come to these conclusions about what is cost-effective, what is clinically effective, actually is derived from a population that matches up with the cancer, the patients who have that cancer that we're treating. So we see here, this is a study from 2008, so it's a little bit older. There's also been updated in 2020, showing the proportion of U.S. patients with cancer. So, okay, if you have this cancer, great. You make up this much of the U.S. population. What do you make up of the trial population? So incidence is blue, and then mortality I want to focus on too, but really importantly is enrollment here. So we see that white patients make up almost 80% of the population who get cancer and are sort of equal across incidence, mortality, and enrollment. In all the other subgroups that these authors reported, that's not true. And so if we go back to that Oncotype study where people are using clinical trial data to develop a biomarker product, if you build it, assuming the enrollment data is accurate here, is reflective of your incidence or your mortality data, you're not necessarily building a biomarker product that's going to be beneficial in the real world. So I think that's a really important takeaway here. And then that builds into this, the importance of diversity in precision medicine. So this study, again, shows that we need to make sure that we're including all patients in all of these studies. This was from the Cancer Genome Alliance, that showed we do a really good job of collecting samples more than we need necessarily to detect a mutational frequency rate in white patients in certain cancers. In some cancers, like lung, squamous, and adeno, we do a really bad job across all populations. But in other cancers, we're sort of concentrating health inequity, I think, in our sample collection process. So I want to make sure we're highlighting not only let's do a good job of getting patients tested, saying yes to figuring out how to test them, but making sure that when we're testing those patients, we're doing it in a way that improves health equity across the population. So identifying those societal and systematic barriers to care and eliminating them as best we can through our policies and our decisions. Dusty, do you have anything you want to bring here? Or I know that you have a patient perspective next that you're ready to share.
Yeah, no, not really. I think you pretty much covered it, Zach, pretty well.
Awesome.
But I will add here that now for this, this is interesting, this slide, when we look at the factors that influence access to cancer care. And we're going to be looking at all the different levels, the patient, provider, systemic, and societal level. But at the patient level, there are multiple factors. Of course, you know, the average age of a lung cancer diagnosis is 70, and I just turned 70 myself, so I can relate. But I was diagnosed at age 51, but at any rate, there are oftentimes comorbidities with a lung cancer diagnosis. COPD is common, and then other issues as well. So, and as we touched on earlier, the patient health literacy. I also wanted to just mention something that's not necessarily on this slide, but as a patient advocate, I think it's relevant, and I think it impacts access to care, and it's the shame and the guilt that a lung cancer patient in particular and some other cancer patients may feel when they get that diagnosis and they feel like they might have contributed to it because of their smoking history, then and their loved ones even might point a finger at them and say, I told you to quit, and you know, and now you've got this lung cancer. And I think that shame and that guilt is a factor in whether they even make a decision to move forward with care, so that you know, the stigma and the nihilism of a lung cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And not only is it at the patient level where they're putting that on themselves necessarily, and their loved ones are doing that as well, but also I think on every one of those levels, you've got a provider who is doing that, you've got systemic level of that and societal level, but I think that's another factor to consider with the others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's hugely important here, and that goes back to that sort of systemic social idea of, you know, mm-hmm. we for a long time sort of, even when I was going through pharmacy school, a lot of our things were patient fault focused, where like, oh, the patient has smoked for this many years, the patient's been an alcoholic for this many years, or struggled with substance use disorder for this many years, not focusing on why the patient may have been exposed to those things in the first place. Was it a societal norm at the time to smoke? You were bullied, there was peer pressure, right? Like, maybe that's what kept the patient happy and alive during a time period where they wouldn't be there otherwise. So I think really when we're thinking about factors that are influencing access from a provider level, yes, it's atrocious that you're not providing guideline recommended care, but I think a lot of why that's happening is through conscious and unconscious bias of, hey, I don't think this patient is health literate enough, or really horribly, hey, I don't think this patient deserves care because they did this to themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where, on a provider level, we can do a better job of supporting and educating and saying, hey, I need you to work to overcome these things. I'm going to give you the tools and education to care for your patient. But there's studies that have shown that even when it's covered, when a biomarker-based test is covered through Medicare, that providers still aren't ordering it because they don't think the patient will want it.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, moving on to systemic and societal level stuff, Diana.
Yeah, I would agree. So if we go to systemic, you know, that it just builds. Patient level issues, the provider level issues, and then there's these systemic issues that are happening as well. Geographic location. Dusty, I know you have a comment on this one, but, it's huge. I come from the state of Utah, so we have the Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake City. But, of course, many of the individuals that live 3-4 hours away from the Huntsman Cancer Institute need care and are facing now a 3-4 hour drive to get to the institution. Radiotherapy, for example, you may need that 3 times a week for a month or 6 weeks. You have a job. How do you manage this? These are real systemic issues that are impacting patients' lives and their ability to access the care.
And the geographic location. I could give you 100 or more stories, but I won't. I'll just give you one. And a friend of mine, she lives in the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, and she has to get a flight to Anchorage and to get even the most basic of care. There's no provider on her island. And when she was going through radiation treatment, I mean, she had to get a place for, you know, over a month, you know, in Anchorage. Who pays for that? You know, not the insurance company. And when she was getting her immunotherapy, it was every 3 weeks, I believe, that she would have to take this flight. And she really struggled with dealing with the insurance. All the stress of that as well. Yes. It's a factor that really impacts quality of care.
I couldn't agree more. It's very real, as all of these are. So the next, you know, culturally competent services, okay, we have many Spanish-speaking patients, and they come into a scenario where there isn't an interpreter. That is more and more commonplace, yes, with Spanish, but we have many, many other languages. Mm-hmm. So this can be a significant barrier to access of care. And the other is, we talked about this in our prep sessions, right, is the healthcare diversity issue, is that you feel the most comfortable when someone that's like you is giving you advice. So that is another difficulty that we have to address. It's so commonplace that the individuals that you're treating are not necessarily like you, and that puts them in an uncomfortable position. So how can we increase the likeness, if you will, of providers and the patients that are having the dialogue, or increasing the connection? It doesn't have to be you, but if you can recommend, hey, I have someone that you could talk to that's gone through the same situation and may be very helpful. We're going to talk about team-based care, but the social worker can play such a huge role in addressing so many of these issues. So we also have affiliation, right? Depending on where you are, is your community oncology clinic affiliated with a research center? And is it 30 minutes away or 5 hours away? Huge issues. There's issues of physical infrastructure, technology of the clinics that you're going to, processes. These processes drive your access to different types of care. And, of course, inadequate staffing. These are draining positions, and turnover and burnout of the staff can be another very real systemic level issue.
I'm going to just interject because you were talking about the geographic also. Yeah. I'm going back to Elizabeth. You know, her and her husband, in the beginning, she was in a wheelchair, and they went to Boston to get her care through that clinical trial. And then, but ultimately, after she did so well on the targeted therapy, she worked in conjunction with a local community care provider, and also, you know, with the Boston team. And I've seen a lot of models like that where the patients are getting their care, decision-making care at the academic center, but they're working with that local provider, which is so much more convenient and probably saves a lot of costs for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. And then finally, just talking to societal drivers here, you know, overall, we look at socioeconomic status, healthcare policies. This is a population-based issue, right? So the third bullet point, a high proportion of underinsured individuals, they all adversely affect access to care and overall quality of care in the population. So we need to consider, you know, inadequate medical insurance, unequal disparate job opportunities, same with educational opportunities and public infrastructure to actually get individuals to be able to access their care in a reasonable amount of time. So it's complex. I will certainly agree with that. What I'd like to close with in our formal slides here is a case study, an example of someone that tried an initiative. It's called the PMQI, Precision Medicine Quality Initiative, and this was run at Texas Oncology. They were trying to improve testing rates and provide patients really unfettered access to targeted therapies and clinical trials based on, you know, full coverage of testing rates. Now, the methods were patients had to have eligible solid tumors, They recommended testing utilizing a broad panel NGS test, somatic tissue or liquid biopsy, whatever made the most sense for the patient. Testing was ordered through a clinical support tool. Then the order was tracked through an EHR system and tracking tools. And this retrospective analysis was done for these eligible patients from January 2022 to March 2023. So you can see here the distribution of the type of tests that were given to this population. And the next slide shows us the results. So as you can see, the biomarker testing certainly increased across all tumor types. So when you take away some of these rather significant barriers, you can see that testing levels will go up, as will that of broad panel NGS tests. They were ordered increasingly over single gene or small panel tests. Liquid biopsies more than doubled, and testing increased in rural underserved regions. Now, from my perspective again, I'm going to say the first three is not really surprising. If you take away coverage barriers, yes, then there will be increased access. I think the one that's most amazing to me is that they reached out. They were able to get to more individuals in rural and underserved regions and increased access to those individuals. So I think that was a significant achievement as well.
I love this slide. In relatively short period of time, what a dramatic improvement. And yeah, it's amazing what Texas Oncology did with that.
So what I would like to see is, and maybe this is an up-and-coming publication, is outcomes, right?
Yeah.
And so it would be great if they had a comparative cohort. It would be great to see the improvement in the outcomes, overall survival, PFS, in these individuals that had full access to this versus those that would not, because that would be the kind of evidence we need to see that actually full coverage can save overall costs and improve patient outcomes.
Yeah, and I guess, sorry, before we move on from this slide, I have a question that I've often sort of struggled with, right? And maybe, Dusty, you can think about this or reflect on it a little bit here. Let's say that you got a broad panel test as a patient and didn't get any actionable results. So you have one version of you that happens to, and another version where no testing was done at all. So you're being treated with the same drug. Do you think in one of those cases, like, which one of those cases would you prefer as the patient necessarily? Where would you be more confident?
Oh, most definitely. Having been tested and ruled out any actionable biomarkers. Otherwise, it's just remorse, what could have been. So, yes, most definitely. Testing and know that, okay, there's no targetable biomarker for you right now or targetable treatment for you right now, but we'll keep on top of it, and hopefully we'll watch clinical trials, and we'll see if something is emerging in that area.
Because I think that's a value that sometimes gets lost in these value frameworks where we're like, we want to see PFS, we want to see OS. But I think, like, clinically speaking, when I have my pharmacist hat on, patients that are like, oh, my provider did everything they could, and I'm still being treated the same way, there's that buildup maybe of a different rapport, a different relationship, better trust than if no testing had happened at all. So I'm hopeful that in some of these value frameworks we start to build around this, we're not just looking at did the result provide an actionable treatment, but is it also changing, you know, how the patient is interacting with their care team and how they feel empowered about the care they're receiving.
That's a great point, Zach, a great point. You know, because, like I mentioned earlier, lung cancer has the highest mortality rate of all cancers. And, I mean, when and if that patient dies and then they later find out about, you know, the potential of biomarker testing, and then those loved ones would be left with the remorse, you know, the what if. What if, had they only tested, what could have saved him? It's a really valid point, and I appreciate you bringing that up.
Well, I'm going to move to this final slide, which really talks about team-based approach for the management of patients with cancer. And we see a lot of different players on this slide, right? We have the pharmacist, we have the pathologist, the patient, caregivers, caregiver systems, the oncology nurse, the medical oncologist, and managed care. So there's a lot of players here. And I think what we saw today is that a lot of these individual circles own certain parts and they don't necessarily share their parts too much with the other individuals to be able to improve and, you know, again, bring the outcomes up, have people have better outcomes, and hopefully try to lower overall costs or understand where coverage decisions around biomarkers really impact overall care. So with this, I'm going to go to each one of you and let you comment on this network here and some thoughts that you have on what kind of changes can we make to have the team work better together. How do we have a multidisciplinary team? How do we put it in practice? What are the processes, et cetera? So, you know, again, with a goal of improving outcomes, quality of life, patient satisfaction, and being, of course, conscious of the cost issue and limited resources.
Well, I mean, when I look at this slide and I think about some of these, managed care, we're probably not going to have, you know, direct contact with managed care as far as, you know, no face-to-face interaction like we do with most of the others. And sometimes that might be to the detriment of the patient, because if a managed care provider, if it was their next door neighbor or their sister or their spouse or something, then I think there might be another level of interest in pursuing the very best standard of care, which is the NCCN guidelines at this point. But you know, so I think they are definitely a part of the team, and you know, hopefully what everyone has learned today will help them to be more engaged and more supportive of biomarker testing and to see the dramatic difference that it can make in a patient's life. So I think about but when I think about biomarker testing, I also think about lung cancer screening. We've got that now, and yet we're really struggling, frankly, with the uptake on screening for lung cancer. The doctors are not necessarily recommending it for their patients, and I think this is just, you know, it's another travesty that we're advocating for. We're doing everything we can to raise awareness about biomarker testing, about screening, to catch it early. You catch it early, you don't even have a need for biomarker testing. I'm a living proof of early stage. Mine was caught by a fluke. I never had biomarker testing done because, frankly, they didn't do it 19 years ago. But I'm cured. I was cured by surgery, and I had some adjuvant chemotherapy, but I have not had a recurrence in 19 years. So I would like that for all lung cancer patients and all cancer patients, you know, catch it early and or get the most effective and impactful treatment for that patient so they can live the best quality of life possible.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Dusty. I think that that's the reflection on, you know, being connected with your patients was really important there. And something that I hadn't thought of until I looked at this picture right now, right, if we look at, you know, I'm going to superimpose oncology pharmacist next to the pharmacist figure there. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, right, if you look at, there's an OCN, oncology certified nurse. You're boarded as a medical oncologist. A pathologist, you're boarded as a molecular pathologist. And most pharmacists that are providing patient care in these situations are board-certified oncology pharmacists. So most of this web, and I'm not trying to single it out, though it probably sounds like it here, are people that have gone down a career path focused on cancer care. And so I'm curious and optimistic that the managed care professionals in this room that are dealing with the parts of policies that are focused on providing cancer care also lean into those same resources. And whether it's a top-down, hey, we're going to recruit clinicians and pharmacists and other people into our team that are passionate about cancer care, or forming some of those in-house tumor boards, right? I think that's sort of, and maybe it exists. Maybe I am completely off base here. I just haven't ever been connected with it. So then it's a marketing issue, a communications issue of, hey, managed care professionals are actually doing this and have this excitement about treating patients with cancer. And that would be great, because I think a marketing issue is a lot easier to solve than an underlying, we need to align on our who's providing care. But I think to me that's sort of the biggest takeaway here is you have a large chunk of people in this picture that are oncology specialized and passionate about that. And I think I see an opportunity here to bring some of that same passion and specialization into the decision makers in the managed care space.
I would agree. And if I look at, you know, the bottom, the two suggested bullets that, you know, what can the team do together to really address the issue of timely biomarker analysis? And is it contracting with the labs? Is it looking at turnaround times? Is it, you know, flow of process through all these providers in a system? And I think, you know, the multi-gene versus single gene, I think, needs to be critically evaluated by cancer, by biomarker, by actionable treatments, and then really put into buckets of appropriate coverage for a health plan. So. Well, the good news is that we actually have a little bit of time to address some more of your very good questions here. I know, we got through it. So we've got about five minutes or so for some of these questions, and they are very good. So let me start with there was a curiosity about looking at the outcomes on that Texas Oncology study. I couldn't agree more. So I think it was interesting to see it was one step. It was an increase of biomarkers, yes, but what was the impact on the outcomes of that study? And I think that would have a really strong impact and be very informative for many of us in the room. So we'll follow up with our colleagues at CME Outfitters and the Texas Oncology Group and certainly keep you updated if any further information comes out about the outcomes. Another comment, the overall total medical costs for the patients and, of course, also the clinical outcomes. Great question is who paid for the testing. I'm going to make an assumption that this group that ran this study probably got an NIH grant, I would assume, that then funded all of the tests, or some potential sponsor, perhaps pharmaceutical, medical device, or lab that sponsored this testing. But again, what this is, it was an artificial environment. Yeah. We were able to afford and cover all tests in this scenario because there was outside external funding. We look at healthcare systems in the real world in the day-to-day, there are not unlimited resources. And that is the issue where we need to match evidence and value and using those resources accordingly. Either of you have any comments on that Texas Oncology study? Any thoughts of next steps or what could be valuable?
Yeah. No, I think beyond where I chimed in already, but Dusty, I'm not sure.
Maybe just, you know, going back to the cost. You were talking, Diane, about the cost. I know that while that is a concern, obviously, for the payers, there should never be a the loss of quality of care. And I think that that's where the magic, you know, spot is to get that balance of the cost with the quality of care. And with the biomarker testing, I mean, there's just no, I just don't see the shortcut. You've got to do the biomarker testing if you're going to provide quality of care.
Yeah, very fair point. So I have a question for both of you to consider, and that is around how can payers or the healthcare team that we talked about in general, how can we affect change in clinician beliefs and biases? It's a difficult question, though.
Yeah, I think the number one thing you can do is engage in those beliefs, like engage in affecting change. And I know that sounds a little circular, but I think to Dusty's point, right, like a lot of patients feel like managed care is sort of detached. Mm-hmm. And so is this an opportunity to do continuing education? Like, I don't want to sit here giving a continuing education, say we should do more CEs, but are there training opportunities and support that can be targeted? Is there contracting around value-based care initiatives that can tackle some of those biases, right? Like, for better or for worse, when I sit down in Epic and an alert fires that says this drug isn't covered for my patient, I'm thinking about that in that moment. So are there other ways to sort of integrate communication that's maybe a positive thing that says, hey, we cover this test and I noticed that it hasn't been ordered for your patient. So maybe that's where that sort of in-house tumor board service could be too. I think it was during one of your sessions yesterday where someone talked about how there was a HER2 positive patient that was picked up by the managed care organization and not the clinician it was during a different talk, but where the managed care organization actually had some of that information and was able to affect change. And so I think about, you know, there's this idea of like support and punishment that a lot of psychology goes back and forth on. And I think the way our healthcare system is set up today right now, a lot of punishment. A lot of the way that we influence care is through punishment or saying no to things. And so I'm wondering if there's ways to sort of flip that script and for managed care professionals to turn around and show how they're saying yes. Give that enthusiastic yes to, we can do this testing. I notice you're not doing that testing. Or I notice, you know, you have socioeconomic data. You know your patient's income levels roughly, right, in the catchment areas you're covering. So can you target those providers that are ordering disparately and use some of that, you know, really large data sets that you have to build targeted interventions that way? So that would be my challenge there to answer that question.
And I want to add health literacy to that. What can we do to impact health literacy?
Well, again, we're putting it on the patient to, you know, to be more literate regarding health. And I mean, that's great. I'm all for that. That's what our organization does. Mm-hmm. And yet, going back to Elizabeth, and, you know, she was highly literate. She didn't realize, though, she had, she thought she had no known risk factors for lung cancer. She never smoked. That's the only thing she associated with, lung cancer. And, you know, then after she got the diagnosis, then she learned about all these other risk factors. She had served in the Navy and a lot of other areas where she, you know, she's not sure, some radon. She has a radon mitigation system in her home. But, you know, it shouldn't be on the patient to do that. And going back to what Zach was saying as well, anyone can get lung cancer. You know, case in point, Elizabeth, and there are many other patients like that who have no known to them risk factors. But no one deserves lung cancer, and they all deserve quality, equitable care. And really, that's what it boils down to.
Would agree.
Well, let me conclude with a summary, and then hopefully some smart goals to actually put into action after our session together today. But in summary, biomarker testing is a critical step in assuring compliance with evidence-based treatment guidelines. So I think the more educated we can become about that, applying it to our processes of care, and then measuring the evidence of improved outcomes because of this. It's your idea. Say yes, and then let's look at the improvement and overall cost later, maybe instead of saying no first and then never being able to observe the improvements because we didn't offer the biomarker test in the first place. We talked a lot about structural racism, social determinants of health, unconscious bias. They do contribute to cancer care disparities, including both screening and treatment. We want to try to eliminate cancer care disparities, but this will require a multi-prong approach, engaging the patient, the provider, the healthcare system, and society. And addressing barriers to care requires a culturally appropriate, linguistically aligned, shared decision-making and coordinating coverage through community oncology and managed care providers. And hopefully today's discussion has given us some materials to think about to hopefully improve that. So what are our SMART goals? So we want to try to put this information into action. Takeaways from this program can be implemented into your practice to improve patient care. So let's ensure that each patient with cancer receives comprehensive biomarker screening through documentation in the EHR. And if the documentation isn't present, follow up with a request for comprehensive testing and documentation in the EHR. And talk with your managed care providers when coverage is denied, working through a prior auth process or working through a dialogue with the medical director to try to state the case why the biomarker testing is important in this case and hopefully then improving access and coverage. Alert supervisors if you see unintentional or intentional biases by your coworkers that affects cancer care. Try to address them, bring that out in the open, and how can we prevent them from happening in the future? Engage in thoughtful self-reflection on your own biases and preconceived ideas about the patient that's standing in front of you, and encourage a navigator. I think we have navigators at Huntsman Cancer Institute, and they are just incredibly valuable to the patients and the processes overall to assist with all issues around coverage and affordability, working with specialty pharmacy to address all the issues of access to the appropriate treatment, patient support that's available from manufacturers, and any other needs that social workers can assist with as well. And then finally, working with supervisors and team members broadly to revise processes that impede patients from receiving guideline-concordant biomarker screening. So with that, I'd again like to thank my co-faculty members here. It was an excellent discussion. Again, I encourage you, if you're interested in free resources and education on today's topic or other CE programs that the CME Outfitters provide, please feel free to visit their virtual education hub. Here is some information on how to engage with CME opportunities through the CME Outfitters. And with that, I want to thank you for your participation and a round of applause for our wonderful faculty. So thank you.